Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Man, oh man, volatility continuing in these markets and the markets broadly continuing to be under pressure. In this weekend show, we're going to spend a lot of time with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. This is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world on the retail and individual side of things. Rick writes in the No Trader. You can also go to that website, inthenotrader.com, and has a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick chooses no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. We're going to spend a lot of time with Rick because I don't want to get too bogged down in any one aspect of the market, because I think we need to cover them all. We don't need to have tunnel vision right now when it comes to markets because of the fact of just how interrelated all of them are, and I think how worried investors generally are, which does impact a lot of these other markets. Rick, starting off simply with U.S. equity markets, headlines abound at the end of the week saying that, oh, the S&P, it's in a bear market now because it is down just over 20%. For the year. There are some people that were encouraged, I believe it was earlier this week or last week, when the S&P bounced right off that 20% down level. Rick, what's your take on this whole narrative that 20% now indicates a bear market when, look, it felt like we were in a bear market well before just the end of this week?
Well, Corey, thanks for having me, and Shad, thanks for having me this week. I saw the headline flash on the news channels today about S&P enters bear market on intraday basis, and I burst out laughing, thinking like, oh my God, I can't believe that the business media is announcing that the market's in a bear market. Like, where have they been for the 4 months that already existed this year? If you couldn't tell that we were in a bear market until today when the S&P crosses over 20%, then you've been asleep at the wheel, and shame on them for making this such a big thing that we're first now in a bear market. And says who? Again, this 20% rule, this idea that 20% constitutes a bear market, is total nonsense. There's no one who's actually attributed to this. It's become folklore over time, mostly generated by business media, whether it's in print or broadcast, because they need ways to engage people and sell newspapers or sell on-air time. It's just kind of a shame and sad to see this being identified as what makes a bear market, and that at 19.9% we're fine, but now that we're 20% down, oh, now we're in a bear market. Shame on them, truly.
Rick, that's a great point, and it's funny how arbitrary some of these levels are that people watch, that everything is fine at 19.9. But I think that there was a lot of indicators the middle of last year that we were starting to enter a bear market. When you looked at the breath readings and when you looked at new 52-week lows hitting a maximum, and you saw some of those Hindenburg warnings and all those different things adding up to, hey, this may be a more corrective period for the market. And we've seen that play through really since the fourth quarter of last year into this year. So how would you say this bear market stacks up to previous bear markets? Because we heard that the 2020 pandemic crash was a bear market, but really that was just a V-shaped flash crash. And then we had the 2008-2009 great financial crisis, but that was kind of a housing market implosion, and it was a very strange one-off event that we still haven't recovered from. Where would you say this bear market compares along the spectrum?
Well, I'll tell you what. In my institutional report, this you had referenced this earlier, supposedly irrelevant factors, that goes to my hedge funds and long onlys who are longtime clients of mine. One of the things I pointed out several weeks ago is that if you look at how much the S&P is beneath its 200-day moving average. And everybody was talking on television about how oversold we are and that we're due for a big bounce and da-da-da-da-da. I looked at it. This was, I don't know, maybe a month ago. And the S&P was only 8% beneath its 200-day moving average. To put that in context, on the COVID low in March of 2020, the S&P was 28% beneath its 200-day moving average. So 8% a month ago, and I updated that this past weekend, I think we were 11.5% beneath. It's nothing. We have plenty. And this is recent history. You know, it's just 2 years back that the S&P was 28% beneath its 200-day moving average. So we're not, you know, maybe we've added a little bit more to that this week. But in historical terms, Shad, we're not close to how oversold we've been. So potentially there's a lot more room on the downside.
Rick, how early on then are we in this bear market? Because look, the one thing about this bear market so far, we're almost 5 months through it, if you just start it from the beginning of this year, it's been relatively orderly. There hasn't been necessarily a shock to one individual sector that has brought everything down. This has been a general meltdown across the board.
Well, yeah, you're seeing, you know, there's nowhere safe. And in fact, if anything, we're starting to see, I guess, a week to 2 weeks ago, they're really, well, maybe it's even a little more than that, but they're really starting to take profits in. When you look at, you know, the really successful tech names that had held the, let's say, the QQQ index, the NASDAQ 100 index up relative to what, you know, the broad NASDAQ composite, its breadth figures topped over a year ago. The Qs had held up because they were the mega caps and they had the most weighting, and you know, these were the FANG type names. But look, recently they've thrown those out the door. There isn't much safety left. The only thing that's really, you know, unscathed right now has been energy. And I actually had clients take off a bunch of energy names earlier this week. Not all of them, but a significant portion of them. Just because this may not end until we see them even, you know, take those down. And longer term, I like energy as a sector. It had gotten down to only 3% of the S&P, right? So XLE, the energy piece of the whole S&P, was only 3% of the S&P. Now it's 4%, but in the past it's been, you know, double digits. So it's been a horrible investment for years and years. And I've said to you guys and plenty of other people, you know, starting last summer, that I thought the long-term bottom was in place and that energy would be a leading sector for quite some time to come. So it's held up the best. It was the best performing sector last year. It's the best performing sector this year. But even now we're starting to see, you know, it's a little profit taking, but if they start taking those names apart, then you know you're finally closer to the bottom. But we're not there yet. Even a piece I put out this morning for one of the companies that I'm affiliated with too said that today's close is actually pretty darn important. And depending upon where the S&P closed today would give us a good sense of whether or not things were going to hold up or not. And same thing with the Qs. And I think, you know, based on right now, as we record, the S&P is down 62 points. That's 1.6%. And the Qs are down 2.4%. That kind of breaks anything that we would have wanted to see hold for today. Now, it's we're only halfway through the day, and the way this market moves, things could be, you know, very different by the time we close. But this would suggest to me we're not likely done if we have a negative close like this today. And I still don't think that. Look, I had a downside target of 36.17 in the S&P, and I have no reason not to think that we can't get there. And it doesn't mean we go straight down there, because we've got a level at 38.19 along the way. You know, there's going to be different levels. And 38.19 is only 20, not even 20 points from where the S&P is now. So we could be there very soon. So it doesn't mean we go straight down. But this is acting like a bear market in every way. Rallies do not hold. And even days that when we have these large up days, like we've seen occasionally, they disappear. So I'm still concerned. I know why, from a counter trend point of view, why we could bounce. I understand from a sentiment point of view why we can bounce. And that is keeping people long or less willing to, you know, be sellers. But this is kind of nasty. And when you think about what the returns have been in the S&P over the last few years, let alone since 2008, or let's say March 2009 when it bottomed, what would be so bad, other than it hurts our pocketbook and our psyche? But, you know, if the S&P fell 25% this year, it's like, you know, it should. Every once in a while, you need this type move. And people are so used to just seeing the market. Imagine if you're somebody who's come in the market in the last 10, 12 years. All you've seen is basically a straight up market. You have no idea how to trade a market like this. You've never seen it. You don't have experience with it. And just a couple of weeks ago, every week on Tuesdays, I do a video for stockcharts.com. And I think it was just maybe 3 weeks ago, one I did that week was titled, like, you need to trade the market with a VIX at 30 very differently than if the VIX is at 20. It's a total different way of trading the market, of looking at the market, of understanding what's going on. And people are so stuck on, oh, buy the dip. You've seen, you know, again, I'm not going to pick out the names, but anybody who watches business television knows that there are two very, very prominent bulls on the street who just don't give up their call. And only earlier this week, one of them did. And it's not like he turned bearish. He just lowered his $5,300 year-end target to $4,800. Gee, thank you very much. A lot of good you do. When the market sells down like it has and the S&P is down 20%, and now you tell me that your target that was a large increase this year isn't going to happen. Thank you very much. You know, why you still have a job on Wall Street, I don't know. I don't know why anybody would still listen to people like that, but they will. And, you know, you kind of, in that respect, you have to know who you're listening to, why you're listening to them, how do they do in up and down markets. And if they always kind of stay in a party line, and the people who don't, and this is true for individual investors, it's true for strategists, portfolio managers, doesn't matter. If you don't recognize what's going on and listen to what the market's telling you, then you're my perfect person that I am going to exploit in this market. And I will outperform you day in, day out, because you are stuck on how you think about the market and are not willing to give up on the call because you're more concerned about being right than you are about making money. And these are the people that I have made a career around exploiting. And why, you know, I'm known on the street as probably the foremost expert in incorporating behavioral finance theory into actually trading markets. It is sad to see, but there's nothing illegal about taking advantage of people who make critical mistakes that others can take advantage of.
Oh, Rick, I couldn't agree with you more when it comes to avoiding those commentators, those analysts that say you need to be all in right now. Back up the truck and put everything into a single stock, even a single sector. That's not how some of the best traders work. It's risky. Maybe you can make a lot of money, but boy, oh boy, you can sure lose all of your money too. this does tie in perfectly to your 7-Eleven report. As I mentioned on the onset, this is one that you write for the retail trader. It is a very straightforward product where you're choosing 7 out of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal of beating the S&P. The fact of the matter is you've been beating the S&P during bull markets and now even during this bear market. We haven't really talked a whole lot about this report, so can you just give us a general overview then of what the 7-Eleven report is all about and how it's been doing so far?
The goal of the 7-Eleven report, as you said in the intro, is to outperform the S&P. Well, we are handily outperforming the S&P this year. As of last Friday, the 7-Eleven report is outperforming by 279 basis points, 2.79%. Now, you may say that, hey, if I'm down 20%, I'm down 18 or 17%, it doesn't matter to me. I'm losing a lot of money. Yeah, but that's not the goal. If you're going to be invested in the market and you're going to keep money plowed into the S&P, regardless of what it does, then why wouldn't you want to outperform with that money that you're going to have in the market anyway? So since we started in the Note Traders 7-Eleven report in August 1st of 2020, we are outperforming the S&P through last Friday by 640 basis points in 21 months. That is huge. And if you're on the institutional side of the marketplace, if you're an insurance fund, if you're a pension fund, if you are an institution that is invested in the S&P using, let's say, spiders as a proxy for how you're invested in it, you'd be doing yourself a disfavor not to look into what we do and how we do what we do, because we, in both up markets and down markets, we outperform.
So, Rick, that brings up a perfect topic of how you then choose the 7 out of the 11 spider ETF sectors right now, simply because, look, it seems like everything's getting pressured. You clearly have had a very good track record in both a bull and bear market. Where do you focus on now in this bear market environment?
Well, look, when you're playing the game of, there's two ways people trade. There's outright absolute return, right? So if you're down 20% this year on the market, you're losing 20% of your money. Nobody's happy with a number like that. But there's also the relative game, which is virtually what every mutual fund out there is playing, which is trying to make more or lose less than their underlying benchmark. And for that part of the industry, which is huge, as is ETFs, which is growing and growing, if you are benchmarked to a broad stock market index, then it is your performance is not judged on how much you make or lose each year. It's how much you outperform your underlying benchmark or underperform. So I know it sounds lousy that if the S&P is down 20% and the 7-Eleven fund is only down 17.3%, that, you know, well, you lost 17.3% of my money. Yeah, but we lost a lot less than if you had been in the market. That's outperformance. That's what people get paid for. And that is what the entire mutual fund industry is based upon. And more so, you know, look, it's funny when I even talk about mutual funds, because I can't imagine anybody who's under the age of, I'll just say 50, it might even be 60, who these days would put money into a mutual fund. Historically, mutual fund managers underperform in droves. Like historically, the number is 86%, can't beat the market over time. And ETFs are so much more tax efficient, and you can actually trade them during the course of the day so that you don't have to wait for the closing price. Imagine you get these days where the Dow ends up down 1,000 points, and when it was only down 300, you wanted to get out, but you sell your mutual fund, but you're going to get the closing price that day. So you're still going to lose 1,000, you know, Dow points worth by the time you get your closing execution price. ETFs are just a much better product than mutual funds in every way. But all these money managers out there who have mutual funds, if they're not a specific, let's call it enhanced strategy, but they're simply trying to beat the S&P, or let's say you're a healthcare fund, so your goal is to beat probably the S&P healthcare index. As long as you have an underlying benchmark, then that game is all about doing better than the benchmark. Whether in an up market or down market, it doesn't matter. It's just make more or lose less. And that's where our product comes in. Once a month, the 7-Eleven report comes out on the last trading day of the month and gives you the new allocations for the coming month. And only in the month of April, since we started this 21 months ago, is the first time that I felt the need to make an intra-month change. So on the mid-month, exactly on the mid-month, we made some allocation changes. And it actually paid off very well because we were trailing up until that point in April, and we actually ended up outperforming by 34 basis points by the end of April. So the change was a good change. But generally, I'm not trying to overmanage this. Once a month, I'm going to tell you in a market newsletter what to be in, which one of the maximum of 7 of the 11 spider ETFs to be in, and what's this universe? XLK, XLU, XLV, XLE, you know, each one of the 11 macroeconomic sectors of the S&P has a very liquid ETF that trades it from State Street. State Street Global is, you know, the advisor on it and who's issued these. So these are hugely, hugely liquid, and we allocate to no more than 7, no less than 5 and no more than 7. And how do we pick them? It is a combination of a quant model that I have and the work we do with behavioral finance, with market timing, with atypical technicals, which tend to be counter trend in nature. And I combine them all to see the inputs, you know, all the different inputs, and we weigh them out and decide which to be in. And obviously, you know, at least for now, well, all I can speak for is the last 21 months that we have an official track record. And in every issue that comes out, you can see every allocation that we've made from day one. So this is completely transparent. There's no leverage to this. We're not, you know, using double inverted ETFs or anything like that. This is simply those very large liquid spider ETFs that we trade. And again, yeah, we're down money this year on an absolute basis, but we're not down as much as the S&P by a significant amount. And if you know anything about the institutional money management industry, 279 basis points in 4.5 months is a huge outperformance. That annualizes to 7.44%. It's virtually unheard of in the money management industry trading the S&P to outperform it that with, you know, those type numbers.
Well, Rick, hats off to you for coming up with this 7-Eleven report and making it simple for people. And I totally agree with the point you just made. I think it was a major point in this interview that the days of just looking at mutual funds and hoping you're going to beat the index are tied to the hopes of those people whose salaries are based on simply beating their benchmarks, not necessarily making you good money or helping you preserve your capital. And so I think it makes a lot more sense to use the ETF structures, as you mentioned, and pick the 7 of the 11 best. I hope people will click on the link below and check out Rick's report, because that keeps it simple and it's something every investor can do. So appreciate you sharing that. Let's dive into a couple of these sectors, though. You brought up the XLE and you brought up energy earlier. It's done quite well. The commodity sector as a whole did quite well over the last, let's say, 6 months to a year. There was a lot of factors there, but they have started to roll over. How are you viewing the energy sector and the commodity sector currently?
So in the commodity space, I still like commodities. I think they're probably shortly due for a pullback, but it's going to be a pullback in a bigger bullish market. You know, we've seen certainly the metal side of these commodity indexes pull back. Energy has not yet. You know, in round numbers, you're still talking about $110, $115 oil. You had nat gas at $8. These are still hugely higher levels than we saw months and certainly you know, a year ago and 18 months ago. And so you've got the massive inflationary pressures that are still here from the Ukraine-Russian war and what that has done to food supply. And you've seen the grain prices, you know, have dramatic moves. So in general, I don't think that game's over yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if you got a pullback because it's run so much. And at some point, they're just going to start taking money out of even what's been profitable. But in general, you know, in a macro sense, I still do like commodities over time. The recent decline we saw just a week or two ago in the CRB index bounced exactly on initial support, came right back to the highs. So we'll see, you know, if you take that out, it's only first level support. But if you take that low out from just 2 weeks back, then you might get, you know, a little, you may start finally getting some more significant pullback there. But ultimately, I'm still going to be looking to buy commodities on a pullback. I don't think the run is over. And if we do go more into recession, you're going to affect, obviously, the discretionary side of things. But when it comes down to it, people still need to eat. And that's a global phenomenon. Human beings do need to eat. And therefore, there will be continuous demand for basic foodstuffs. That, along with supply chain issues, should keep that, you know, the commodity markets in general somewhat elevated. But, you know, the metals are a different question. Energy, if we go more into a recession, you're going to see less demand. I know, you know, Corey, you're up in Canada. Here in the U.S., you know, now you're paying close to $5 a gallon for it. Certainly $4.50 is not out of the question.
Rick, we're paying $2.25 a liter in Vancouver.
That's a liter, right? Well, yeah, it's anywhere, but the U.S. has always been more expensive. So when, you know, I see the other day I was filling up my car, and I think it's a 15-gallon tank. So, you know, I'm pushing $70 to fill up. But the guy next to me had one of these large SUVs, and it crossed over $100. That hurts. That is a direct tax. And it, unfortunately, it's, if I remember my economics right, but I think they call that a regressive tax in the sense that, you know, it doesn't matter what your income is, you're paying that same thing. So this hurts lower income people even more, because if they got to drive to work, they got to fill up their cars. My daughter, who lives in Florida, has to drive 50 miles each direction to work each day. And, you know, 100 miles a day in the car commuting, it's costing her a fortune just to get to and from work. So whatever income, you know, whatever her salary is, the salary is still there, but her net effect to her is much less because she has to spend so much more on just getting to the office each day. So if oil stays, you know, oil, I think, stays here. But even if we pull back into the 90s in oil, it still hurts people. It's a real issue over time, and is going to affect people's willingness to spend on other things. And I think it's going to really start affecting people. And just if you have to drive to work, you have to drive to work. You either change where you work or you suck it up. But if you are constantly taking two-hour trips for weekend little getaways or, oh, honey, let's go, you know, let's drive an hour and a half north to take a hike in the nice wooded area, you may think twice about that when the stock market is coming off and you're seeing your personal wealth decrease and then you see what you have to pay for gas. You may, you know, stop and think about some of the things you do and the expenditures you make. And that's all part of how the market may still be in, you know, some serious trouble.
Yeah, I feel like we're just waiting for the consumer to almost leave the market, right? Because of just how much they're getting squeezed. And you're right, higher gas prices affect lower income people even more sometimes than the higher income people. What about the metals then, Rick? You mentioned a little bit of the metals, but I want to start with base metals, because base metals still historically quite high in their prices. But even something like copper's come back off of $5 a pound down to, let's say, broadly in the 420 region. So again, still high historically, but has come off its highs. And with all the fear that's out there in the world and this almost liquidity squeeze that we're getting, do or can the base metals go higher from here, or are they going to continue to be under some pressure?
So one of the ways, Corey, that I look at base metals, one of the proxies, I look at copper, and I frequently comment on copper to institutional clients. I don't to retail, but I do to institutional. But, you know, for retail, for the average person, one of the ways to just get a sense of what base metals are doing is to look at the ETF with the ticker symbol XME. It's a base metals type of, it's an industrial metals type of ETF, and it gives you a decent sense of what's going on there. And it's come off a chunk recently, as has names like Freeport Mac, you know, FCX. These things have fallen hard recently. Longer term, sure, there's still positive long-term charts. Shorter term, not so pretty. And what I do is when there's a sector that I kind of want exposure to, but I want to reduce, but not necessarily get out of or have the capital gains taxes that I'd have to pay if I sell out, and then also wonder with the volatility of this market, where it means I'm forced out for 31 days. Otherwise, if I come back in, you have to deal with the wash rule here in the U.S. Then what I often do I'll sell covered calls against what I have. This way, it creates some income. You know, like the XME right now is trading at 49 and change. I don't know, maybe it was a month ago, give or take, maybe even a little more, I sold some $61 calls. So I collected a couple dollars on those. And, you know, what it does is cushion some of the down move that we've seen. So it allows me to still have exposure there. But it just, let's put it this way, it hurts a little less by having sold calls again. So for those of you who are listening to the show, and only if you understand the options markets and have, you know, signed all the documents you need to trade the options markets and all those disclosures that say you understand the losses, the loss potential of using options, only if you understand them, well, then I say, you know, look into using those against some core positions. It's a way of being able to stay in what you want, but reduce, you know, some of the downside. You know, I look at gold that multiple times tried to get above 2000 and got above $2,000, but these were like a day or two and that was it, and then it come right off. Gold has broken beneath where it needed to hold, and it's been disappointing. And I have, and I've always had a small piece of my portfolio on gold, like literally no more than 2%. And gold's roughly flat on the year, and the S&P is down 20%. So it's been a good hedge, and that's with a very strong dollar. Imagine where gold could have been if we didn't have the strong dollar. But we do, and it makes owning gold, it takes away for the appeal of owning gold because gold is priced in dollars. So the higher the dollar costs, yeah, the negative impact it has on the price of gold. As we're talking, I'm gonna look into where, you know, what XME looks like now and if there's any new key levels to look at based upon it. But generally, when you think about the base metals do well in a growing economy and just before the economy starts to grow, because that's when you get, for instance, China coming in and buying lots of copper for future expansion in China. And China is, you know, kind of the biggest importer around. Let's see, the weekly chart. Yeah, you're in no man's land. You're beneath the middle Bollinger Band, for those of you who know that. So you're beneath kind of the 20-week moving average. Stock's trading 49 and change. And to me, it looks like we could get down to the low 40s. So you're still going to have some downside here. There's, from here and now, doesn't mean we could stop going down right now and turn around and go higher. But that's not happening unless the market does that too. And so you have to like the market enough. And as we think about in the time that we've recorded this now, the S&P is now down 72 points. So, you know, it's getting trashed here on a Friday, just another bad week and another bad ending to a bad week. So hard to say why it's done with here and now.
Well, Rick, as you know, on our show, there's a lot of listeners that follow the hard assets and are very interested in the precious metals as a way of preserving purchasing power, not so much as a speculative instrument. But a lot of people are disappointed when we talk to them and have been, let's say over the last year or so, that gold didn't perform better in light of, I mean, we saw a little blip on the Ukraine issue, but in light of the high inflation, it didn't really act like an inflation hedge. And a lot of people have dismantled that narrative and said it's not really inflation hedge, but it is a chaos hedge. And we are seeing weakness in the general markets. Why do you think it is that it's not getting a little bit more safe haven bid? And it seems like all that safe haven bid dumped into the dollar. They sure didn't dump into bonds. They've dumped into the dollar over bonds and gold.
Right. So I agree with what you've said in everything you just said about this. But gold also has competition like it never used to have. And that's this, you know, kind of unproven crypto world that many people say that they'd rather have their money in crypto than in gold. And
that younger generation, right?
Oh, sure. One's a proven long-term hedge against disaster, and one is brand new, speculative, and has no proof of anything yet. There is a significant amount of people, from what I read, well now over 50% of those who are invested in the crypto space who are underwater. Right. And it's not just in Bitcoin. There's lots of other coins out there. But if we want to just put it in Bitcoin terms, simply because it's the most recognized and liquid of them, Bitcoin topped at what, about $68,000, and has been steadily declining. Two, 3 weeks ago, I think it was, the press quoted me because it was trading at 38,000. And I said, if we give anything away here now, we're going to have a very quick $10,000 drop. And it's exactly what we got over the subsequent few weeks. We're hanging out now where we, I don't know, 29,000, 30,000, somewhere around there. The amount of people who are long this at 40,000, 50,000, 60,000. And it's not like your average 25-year-old kid had $60,000 to buy it, right? So they buy a fraction of a Bitcoin through Robinhood or whatever place now that, you know, was their favorite flavor of the week brokerage firm to go and do this stuff with. It's a shame, but you know, this is kind of, to me, tulip mania just in the modern day. This is unproven. You've got your complete believers who are essentially making a binary bet because they're betting everything on this happening. And if it works for them, kudos for them, because then they will have aptly been rewarded for the risk they took, which is, let's bet everything, you know, let's bet the house, my kids' college education, and everything on this unproven thing that hopefully is going to be worth a lot of money down the road. I've said to you before, I say it to people all the time, I do lots of public presentations, and I speak at seminars and conferences, and choose a dollar amount that you're willing to put into this hype. Have that amount be not significant enough that if you lost it all, you would materially have to change your life. But this way, so let's say you put a few percent in and it goes totally bust, right? Well, you've lost 100% of that few percent of your total portfolio, and that's it. And you were wrong and you lost it all. That I can live with. The people I talk to who have 50% or more of their total assets in crypto, you're in a totally different game. And you're doing the number one thing that investors should never do, which is hope. When I buy a stock, I buy it because my gut tells me it's the right time and place to do it. And I have some inner peace of this is the right thing to do. My head is not in the hoping space that, like, oh, I buy stock XYZ and I hope it goes higher. Hope is not a successful emotion and driver to why you should do something. And for all these people, no matter what your age, hoping that this crypto story pans out over the next 5 years, 10 years, or whatever it is nothing more than hope built on hype. And maybe it's right, and maybe it works. And I know you're 25 years old and you want to be the next Mark Zuckerberg and you want to be a multi-billionaire and you think crypto is your way to get there. And if you do that, that's up to you. And if it works for you, say kudos to you for taking ridiculous risk, but it worked out for you. For the average person, that is a very, very silly bet. So if you want to bet that Bitcoin's going to go to $100,000 and it's trading now 30-ish, fine. You know, you tripled your money if it goes here. Great. But would I put all my money in it? Absolutely not. Would I put half my money in it? Absolutely not. The same way I wouldn't put half my money in an individual stock. Now, if you put half your money in Apple 20 years ago, you're a hero. But you had to have known that that was the stock at the time and place to do it. Same thing for, let's say, Amazon, right? You made a killing. But for most people, we're, and me included, we're not smart enough to know what's that next great Apple coming down the road. And forget those who tout it on social media. These people tell you, you know, here's the next great Apple. And if you subscribe to my news service, we'll tell you what the next great Apple is. That's utter BS, folks. Stay away. That is just somebody who wants your money, who's also going to sell and collect your email and sell it to somebody else. Most of those places, that's what they do. They sell email lists. So they get all these suckers who say, you know, I'll take the free this and the free that. They're just making money by collecting emails and selling tens of thousands of email addresses to a marketer.
Yep. Watch out for those comments. The back up the truck. You need to go all in right now. Those are never good investment strategies. However, they do catch people's attention. And we see them in every sector. And that is the problem, right? If you get just too into one sector even, you can get burned because no one knows where these markets are going. Rick, we've chatted about a lot of different markets here. I want to wrap it up with a comment outside of these markets, dealing more with economic data. Because as we've moved through this last decade plus, two decades really, economic data is immediately related back to what the Fed might do in terms of easy money policies. Right now, all we hear about is inflation and potential recession or stagflation. What data are you watching that you think actually makes a difference in these markets?
Well, I go back to looking at that, most importantly, price is king when it comes to looking at the data you're looking at. Is you know, you look at a chart of a stock. Is it A, heading upward or downward? B, what speed is it moving at? And C, if I think I want to put a play on in that, what do I need to know beforehand that I'm missing? Let me put it this way. If you're selling a stock, the only way you can sell that stock is because somebody's buying it. Otherwise, you can't get that trade off. So somebody's buying what you're selling out of, and vice versa. You buy a stock, somebody's selling it to you. If they're selling it to you and you're the buyer, they think that stock's going down. Otherwise, they wouldn't be selling. You think it's going up. Otherwise, you wouldn't be buying. That puts them just on in equal terms as you, as being potentially as smart. What do they know that you don't know? Why is it that I could buy the stock here and now from somebody selling it to me? Are they selling it because it's sold down so much that they can't take the pain anymore, and therefore I'm maybe taking advantage of their pain by buying at a level that I think over time is a smart place to get in? And vice versa, you know, the other way around. So I always want to know and think about, when you talk about data, I want to think about what's the data out there that allows me to get this trade off because somebody is completely disagreeing with me. That's number one. Number two, look at the general trend of the market. Number three, look at the trend of the underlying security you're actually looking at and put those pieces of the puzzle together to figure out, is this the time and place relative to the risk I'm willing to take? I'll tell you something I did for myself. I didn't publish. Oh, I actually did tell my institutional clients this. A few weeks back, I bought Netflix for myself at $164. And I don't know the exact low, but it's somewhere in the low 160s. So I bought it the day it made the low. But the funny thing is I put that order was in over a month before it got there. I had pecked, so this was after their earnings report came out that the stock, you know, blew up from the, I don't know, where was it, the 200s or 300s down to where, you know, had that huge down day. But I did my homework to pick where would I be comfortable buying in virtually any scenario that I could take advantage of some poor soul who's selling out because they've like called their broker or they can't take the pain anymore. And they're like, just get me the heck out of that name at any cost. I don't care. Just sell it. And I came up with 164 from the research I do. And this is, I can virtually guarantee nobody else out there would have come up with this level. So it's not an obvious chart point. It's not prior support. This actually was a fairly complicated thing I came up with. And for now, it's working. So as bad as the market is, Netflix, you know, I'm not losing money on a large cap tech stock I bought a few weeks ago. You can't say that about many of them. But this one was so beaten down that I was willing to take the chance weeks before it ever got there, that if it got there, I'd be willing to make my investment and stick my neck out, you know, and do my buying there. So right now it's at, you know, it's still down 1.7%. It's $180. It had been into the mid 190s. But I'm kind of saying to myself, I think I'm willing to be a holder at that point, and I'll take the chances that it's not going to materially go lower than that. So that, you know, there's a way of kind of doing this where you do your homework and you pick your places that you're willing to take a stab, especially in a market that can be as erratic as this, that you try to take advantage of other people's misfortune in the sense that you're buying that, you know, when they can't, they just can't take the pain anymore. I did it with months ago with Cleveland Cliffs. I bought a couple hundred shares at 60, I think it was 1602, but I had the bulk of them. I had 500 shares down at 1578. And I think the low of the move, and that order was sitting for months at those levels. And I missed that second order, which is really where I wanted to do the bulk of the buying, by a nickel. And then Cleveland Cliffs, you know, doubled in price before falling back down now into the low 20s. It got to the mid 30s. That's the type of stuff that, you know, try to do when you ask me, you know, how do you pick what you do and when you do and how do you figure out what to do in markets like this? As long as it's legal and everything you do is completely kosher, you know, you try to take advantage of other people's mistakes. That's why the behavioral finance side of this is so important.
Hey, Rick, I find it fascinating the way that you're viewing markets and the way that you have traded them, because we've talked for a couple of years now, and you do have a slightly different outlook than a lot of, well, most of the mainstream media, but you're also not tied to any individual sector. And I think that's also important too, to understand, as I said at the very start of this show, was not getting too tunnel vision in your sector, in any individual sector, because right now you need to understand there is this general selling pressure that's coming from a wide range of other areas. And it sounds like more of a defensive strategy needs to be taken right now, and there isn't one easy defensive road. So everything you've shared with us, I really appreciate it, Rick. It's great having you on the show as often as we do, and I hope everybody listens as closely to what you say as Shad and I do. As Shad mentioned, we will be posting a link to the In the Know Trader website below or within the weekend show posting. Everyone, please go check out that link. Let us know and let me know if you have any follow-up questions for Rick Bensignor. Rick, it's been great chatting with you on the show. Thank you again for taking time on your weekend to share all of your thoughts. Everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show. We'll be back with you next week, hopefully in a better market environment, but that sounds like it might be a little ways off still. Rick, thanks again. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, guys. Thanks for having me.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.